When you drive Tipo's wheels, 'cause you found a great deal, that's amore. So to be in the know, come test drive a Tipo, that's amore.
The new Fiat Tipo, from £159 per month with 0% APR. Amore for less. 2699 customer deposit, 6639 optional final payment. Term 24 months. Fiat Tipo EZ 1.495 HP PCP sales only. 10,000 annual mileage until the 31st of December 2016. Subject to status. Fiat Financial Services.
Blog Talk Radio.
Week 7 of Callous Remarks with my man Steve Callous. I'm Joe Stazak. Another 45 minutes of second level analysis of the sports landscape. And without further ado, the star of the show, he is Steve Callous, joining me right now. Hello, Steven. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, Joe. Good to be with you as always. Looking forward to this show. World Series, Cavaliers, ring night.
Pretty jacked for this show. It's a pretty big night. Let's start with baseball. We're going to go a little different this week. I know we usually kick it off with the NFL, but big night in Cleveland. They haven't something like this since they cut the ribbon on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame out there. They don't have a lot to do in Cleveland, at least for the last century or so. The Cavs, a big winner last June, coming back from 3-1 down. I still think one of the great comebacks slash upsets, whatever you want to call it, in the history of the game, considering how they did it and who they did it to and where they did it, beating the Golden State Warriors. And then, of course, the Cleveland Indians haven't won a title since 1948, a baseball title, playing the Chicago Cubs, who haven't won a World Series since 1908. And the World Series began in 1903. That was like their fifth or sixth year of the World Series. Haven't won since. Here they are again tonight, big night. Your thoughts on championship night or whatever do they want to call it out in Cleveland?
Well, I thought they should have moved that Cavaliers game up to like 6 p.m. I know it's a TV TNT game and all that, but they have announced that they're going to start the ring ceremony at 7:30. So at a minimum, if you're home and TV in Cleveland, or even I guess if you're a wealthy person who has season tickets to both, you can see the ring ceremony at 7:30 p.m. Literally walk across the street there to see first pitch in the World Series at 8:08. It is kind of an amazing accomplishment, and as I've told you, I spent a lot of time in Cleveland. My son went to college 30 miles from Cleveland and worked his first year out of college in Cleveland. I've been to Progressive a bunch of times. I've been to the Q once. I was actually in a hotel near Cleveland the night that LeBron James made the decision. And I can tell you way back then, walking out of a hotel room down by the bar in the hotel, people were crying, cursing. The burning jerseys hadn't started yet, but here we are now, all these years later, and everybody's in love with Cleveland, unless you're a Browns fan.
Wow, that's unbelievable how quickly things kind of turned around for LeBron. Coming back from Miami and taking the Warriors down last year. Their payroll, by the way, their starting five, over $100 million, which is more than, I believe, 18 NBA teams combined with their whole salary for the entire roster. It's a big and a pretty expensive lineup tonight. So it is exciting for Cleveland. Haven't done it in so long. But here you got the Cubs factor too. I mean, there's more to this story because the Cubs, with all their the history of the Billy Goat and Bartman and all the things that have gone wrong for them, and something's got to give. I know you picked the Cubs, I believe, in the beginning. And by the way, congratulations. You had the Indians, too, facing the Cubs in the World Series, and here we are. Both teams haven't won in so long. Who do you like?
Well, I still like the Cubs. Look, what the Indians have done is amazing. They are, at least on paper, lack of starting pitching going into the playoffs. The whole Trevor Bauer drone incident. I don't know if you heard the Francona quote where he said, well, absent another drone incident or an airplane, something or other, you know, I think we'll have enough pitching. They put Danny Salazar on the roster, the World Series roster, but as you probably know, he was an all-star, yes, but he was terrible in the second half. He did have those arm issues. He's only pitched a three-inning simulated game. I don't know exactly what they can give him. They say Trevor Bauer has totally healed, but it was only a week ago where there was blood all over the pitcher's mound. So I still like the Cubs. I like the Cubs in six. I mean, when you look at their three guys, Lester, Hendricks, and Arrieta, those are three awful good starters. Lester, of course, World Series winning experience. And John Lackey, I'm not a Lackey guy, but to have him as your number four guy, maybe it'll depend on how the first three games go. You know, Francona has already said he might use Kluber on short rest in game four. And again, that's usually a decision that has to be made, I think, depending on where you are. If you're up 2-1, you'd probably rather have him on short rest. If you're down 2-1 or 3-0, heaven forbid, it might be a different deal. The Cubs also, as you know, they put Kyle Schwarber on the World
yep.
Series roster. What a story. Hurt on April 7th, third game of the year, collision in the outfield with Dexter Fowler. And look, Schwarber's future to me has always been in the American League as a DH. As great as he was last year, including five home runs in the postseason, he's pretty bad in the field. But he's back just to be the DH in the American League Park, and probably to pinch hit. I don't think you'll see him on the field. But that's a big – I don't think we outside Chicago quite understand that Schwarber is so loved by his teammates and almost a folk hero in Chicago based on what he did in last year's postseason. I think this is a boost more than getting another lefty in the lineup besides Rizzo, who finally woke up at the end of the last series, because basically, as you know, Chicago is a right-handed hitting team and Cleveland is a right-handed pitching organization, except for, of course, the best reliever in baseball, Andrew Miller.
Let me ask you something, Steve. We're Steve Callis. I'm Joe Stazak. You know, this game tonight, the Cubs have been playing baseball more recently than the Indians. The Indians have been off for a week, and I heard David Justice last night say that back in 2001, and I'm sure this happens to a lot of players, and I can see why, the time off, you can't simulate a 95-mile-an-hour pitch necessarily when you're warming up and practicing. And he said the worst thing you want to do when things are going well and you're hitting the ball is take time off. And he said the first at-bat he took against the Diamondbacks in one of those series back in 2001, he's like, whoa, his timing's a little off. You're seeing it for the first time in a week. Your eyes need to adjust. How much do you think that will affect the Indians, considering this team was, you know, on such a roll heading into the World Series?
Well, I think it does affect them a lot, and I'll give you a fascinating stat that I wasn't aware of till yesterday, and that is since 2009 – so that's 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. Every team that won their series first lost the World Series. Going back to the Phillies in 2009. Texas in 2010 and 11. The Tigers in 12. St. Louis in 13. Kansas City 14 last year. Certainly as a New York guy, the Mets swept the Cubs. You'll remember that. And they finished early, and Kansas City beat them in the World Series. So that does not bode well for the Cleveland Indians. Of course, past performance is no indication, blah, blah, blah. But it is interesting. It's not just to hear it from Justice. A player, of course, is a big deal. But the stat that every one of these teams that has finished first lost is really kind of a trend. Again, I'm not a big gambler, but that's kind of a trend when you look at it. If the last seven teams to win the pennant first lost in the World Series, boy, that's something you'd have to look at in this series as well.
Agreed. Now, let me ask you something, because I saw the Cleveland second baseman, Jason his name escapes me. Second
Kipnis.
Baseman for the Indians. Thank you, Kipnis.
Kipnis.
I said this a few months ago when we were talking baseball on the air. I said, if the Cubs get to the series, and I said it a little tongue-in-cheek, but it was a thought, if the Cubs get to the series, I might throw out Steve Barton for the first pitch and try to exercise some ghosts. He came out and said this. You know, Kipnis was a big Cubs fan growing up. Now he plays for the Indians. He thinks that that would be something that the crowd would go wild and blah, blah, blah. My partner then said, yeah, but if they end up losing this series, guess who gets blamed? And it's going to be Bartman, and he's going to go through another, you know, two decades of, solace and you know, he'll
therapy.
Disappear again. But with therapy, Right. What do you think of an idea like that? Or for Cleveland, you know, Ernest Biner, I won't say Edgar Renteria, maybe Jose Mesa. I don't know, something to kind of exercise a ghost. Or do you think they all stay away from that those things because of the superstitions?
I think I would definitely stay away. I'm a superstitious guy. I would stay away from that. But I have a couple of interesting things on that topic. First of all, as you said, Kipnis is a Chicago guy. But I don't know that a lot of people know that Kipnis not only lived in the same neighborhood as Steve Bartman, he actually went to high school with Steve Bartman.
I did know that, yes.
With Steve Bartman's sister. So
no
Kipnis actually
way.
Said he had a tear in his eye when the Cubs won, because he's a lifelong Cub guy, you know, Cub fan, obviously Indian
sure.
player. And you also
sure.
know there's a problem that Kipnis hurt his ankle in the celebration. He stepped on
yes.
Lindor's foot, and that's apparently not just a little aside. That's apparently a problem. On the other side, what I wanted to talk about, which I'm very disappointed in, and I don't know if it's changed. As of yesterday, it hadn't been. There's a guy named Eddie Robinson, who is the oldest living New York Yankee, but he's also the only survivor of the 1948 Cleveland Indians World Series winning team. He was the first baseman and a very good player on that team, who eventually went on to other teams and was a four-time All-Star. Now, Eddie Robinson is 95 years old. He lives in Fort Worth, Texas. There was an article in the New York Daily News that anybody can Google from 4 or 5 days ago where he said, "I can't believe these guys haven't called me." And I don't know why he's not. Now, I don't know if he can throw a pitch at 95, but I don't know why he's not the guy. That would be the guy I would bring to Cleveland if I was an Indians guy, because he wrote a book, which I haven't read yet but plan to, Lucky Me, My 65 Years in Baseball. He played in the majors in the 40s and 50s, but then has been like he was even the general manager of the Texas Rangers from like 1976 to 82, and he's a living legend, walking encyclopedia. I don't know why there hasn't been more. There's been stuff written about him, but I have no idea why he's not in the owner's suite for games 1 and 2 of the World Series.
That is amazing. I'm wondering – You almost, it's mind-boggling. Is that an oversight, or why would you not bring back a guy from that team, the oldest living, you know, player from the last World Series team? You know, that's something that and then he mentions it, and they still don't do anything about it.
Well, I'm hoping the Cleveland locals, the local media, certainly I told our friend Rick Morris about it, who's out in Cleveland. I hope somebody gets in touch with them. I have to think they know now. It was in the Sporting News. It was in the New York Daily News. I actually haven't seen it in a Cleveland paper, and as of yesterday, I looked. But my goodness, could you ask for who would think there'd even be a guy alive? And I've seen, actually, there's videos online of him in the last couple of years talking about how he doesn't like the new slide rule at second base.
Right.
I mean, very lucid
sure.
guy. Looks like he's in good shape. You would never guess he's 95. So I hope they do correct that, if not for the first game, then certainly for the second. But I'd certainly stay away from the bad luck guys of the past. I'm sure if you're a Cleveland fan or a Cubs fan, you just want to erase all those demons. I don't know if you want to be reminded of them.
Well, we're Steve Callis. I'm Joe Stasek, Sportsology, here for another half hour. Last one before we get to football, Steven. You've had a chance. I'm sure that you may have covered this guy when he managed the Mets. I ran into Bobby Valentine on my trip in L.A., and notoriously, he was the biggest curmudgeon. I did a whole show once on the biggest jerks in sports. He was in the top five. And I know other people in my station have dealt with him. One almost fought him when he covered the Cubs in Chicago a long time ago. Could not have been nicer. Could not have been more engaging, charismatic. When I ran in, I pulled him aside and we chatted. He stayed at our table for a while, and he could not have been more engaging. And what were your opinions of him, or what did you know about him when he was a manager of the Mets and other teams, and what he's done, and your thoughts on Bobby V? Because I was stunned.
Well, I actually met Bobby a couple of times in my life, and if you grew up where I grew up in the Northeast, I don't think a lot of people know that Bobby Valentine was a legendary athlete in Connecticut, not just a baseball player, but a football player as well. He was slated for stardom in the professional leagues and then in professional baseball and had a couple of injuries. I don't know if that gave him a negative view on things, a negative slant, but he's a brilliant baseball guy. Yes, I agree with the curmudgeon. Yes, I think he doesn't suffer fools well, and if you really don't know, and I'm not saying you or any of these other guys didn't know, but if he thinks you ask the wrong question or a bad question, I think he just takes that personally for some reason and goes off. I think now you probably met the older, wiser Bobby Valentine. I actually know a few people who coach up at Sacred Heart, Sacred Heart University up in Connecticut. Bobby Valentine's day job, if you will, is he's the athletic director at Sacred Heart University. And I know a few people who have dealings with him now, and it's the exact opposite of what we knew when he was the manager of the Mets.
Yes.
Although, while you're competitive, I think, as an athletic director, it can't possibly be the same as being competitive as a player or competitive as a manager, as he was. But still a brilliant baseball guy. I think you met the older, wiser, more mature Bobby V. And I had heard that he went out to Los Angeles, actually, to spend some time with Tommy Lasorda, who had been ill. Now, I saw them together at one of the playoff games, so Lasorda was at a playoff game, so he must be better. But certainly, as you know, they're very close, Lasorda and Bobby V. So I think you just ran into the new version, the last maybe five-year version of Bobby V, who still does, SNY TV in New York, the Met station. He still frequently was a guest during the season to give some commentary in studio on the New York Mets. So I just think now he's kind of matured, and he's a softer, gentler Bobby V, if you will.
Yeah, much more. I did ask him what he was doing out there, and he did mention Tommy Lasorda. I said, how's he doing? And he really looked his face changed, and he did not go into details, but he kind of shook his head. I don't know what that means, but he seemed very upset about the health or the situation
right.
with Tommy Lasorda. But he was fantastic. I asked him, actually, the only question, besides who's going to win the series, I asked him about if he still ballroom dances. I don't know where I pulled that out of. I know he was a ballroom dancer, and he kind of broke the ice. He laughed. He kind of broke the demeanor, and he thought that was funny, and we talked a little bit about that, and he was cool. He was cool. He's very cool, and my opinion certainly is a lot different than when I covered him
right.
for Fox back in the day when he was managing the Mets. But prayers certainly go out to Tommy Lasorda, and certainly going to be an interesting situation tonight in Cleveland and forward game one of the World Series and the ring ceremony for LeBron and company. Let's get to the NFL, my friend. Week 7 in the books. I thought the most interesting, and not just because I'm from around here and I cover this team, most interesting game was the return of Sam Bradford to Philly, playing Carson Wentz, the guy who basically was the heir apparent and who replaced Sam and made him expendable, and he was traded to the Vikings, had a 5-0 start, and then they imploded on Sunday. Your thoughts on that game and what you took away from it? Did it change your mind about the Eagles at all? Did it change your mind about the Vikings at all?
Changed my mind a little. I like the Vikings. As we both know, you liked Philly, and I'm hoping you're going to explain that to me so I can learn something on the picks. But I will say this. I'm not a Jim Schwartz fan, but he's an excellent defensive coordinator, Philly's defensive coordinator. I think the most embarrassing thing I've seen in the last at least 10, if not 20 years on an NFL football field between coaches was that Jim Schwartz
Harbaugh
thing after a Detroit 40. And it was so embarrassing that if you had a 12-year-old at home, I don't think you could explain to him or her what the heck had happened. They were so bush league. So I've had a negative view of both of those guys. Not that they can't coach. I know Harbaugh is now at Michigan doing a great job in the college ranks.
Yeah.
But Schwartz
yep.
as a defensive coordinator, that might be his calling. And, you know, in retrospect, and I'll be interested to see what you say because you picked the winner. I did not. But in retrospect, you know, it's true that if you had that guy, Sam Bradford, last year, I think it was 7-7 in Philly, that you have a real good vision into what he does, what he thinks, what he is. But I was shocked. I liked Minnesota. I was shocked because I'd like to hear the Elias Sports Bureau tell me in the history of the NFL – have there been three turnovers on the first three possessions of a team who then came back to win the game relatively easily? Because that's what happened, as you know. Of course,
yeah.
Bradford then,
yes.
They turned it over twice in a row as well. But here's the interesting thing to me looking forward, because Philly has that big game against Dallas, as you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But
sure.
In the second half, they totally took the ball out of Wentz's hands. He became a game manager. They became a
yep.
rushing team. I haven't seen a 98-yard kickoff return like Josh Huff did this year. I don't know if that's the first, but I can't even see guys get past the 25. But what I wanted to focus on was Wentz in the second half against Minnesota. He was 7 for 8. But for, like,
yep.
no yardage, his average throwing distance, I don't know if you saw this stat, his average throwing distance was 1.3 yards per throw, which means he threw a couple sideways. He
a lot
threw
of swing
a couple
passes.
3-yard slants. He threw a couple backwards, which would be laterals, not passes. But
sure.
they it's clear that Doug Peterson wanted to take the game out of his hands. His final stats, you know, we're not very good. He did throw 2 picks. So I don't know if Wentz is going from the hottest young quarterback in football the first, what, 2 or 3 weeks to now
yep.
a game manager. I don't know. But I think Philly has come back to the pack a little, not based on this win. That's a big win. But Minnesota has also come back to the pack. But I will say this, Zimmer is a Parcells guy. And I'm a huge Parcells fan. I think he's one of the greatest coaches of all time. And Zimmer, after the game, was so angry. I think you're going to see a different Vikings team this week, because those kinds of coaches, and there aren't a lot of them, those kinds of coaches will now whip your team into shape this week. This is not we're going to pat you on the back. This is we're going to kick you in the butt. And I think you'll see a different Vikings team. But, yeah, I thought the most interesting thing, and I want to hear what you think, Schwartz defensively against the Bradford was certainly obviously able to shake him up a bit, and that was the deciding factor in the game.
No, I agree. And, Brandon Graham, defensive end for the Eagles, said afterwards, listen, we played with him in training camp. He doesn't like to get hit. I mean, I don't know anyone who likes to get hit. You know, it's maybe Carson Wentz, and that'll get old pretty soon. But they do not blitz a lot. Jim Schwartz doesn't blitz a lot. He likes to put pressure from his front four and drop 7 back, notoriously. I think before this game, entering the game, they had only blitzed 8% of the time. I think that number went up to 16 and then some. I think that number's a little soft, but they blitzed. They brought pressure from a lot of areas, cornerbacks, safeties, extra people up the middle, and they hit him. They sacked Sam Bradford 6 times, and they hit him an additional 9 times, and just not giving him time to throw. He does not do well when there's either real pressure or perceived pressure. And having said that, the Vikings just overall imploded. You look at – and Mike Zimmer, he was right on the money. I mean, he called his team soft, which certainly they didn't appreciate, but he was right. But the game was kind of a mess, and you're right about a team that turns the ball over 3 times in their first 3 possessions. There were 8 turnovers combined, 9 fumbles, 3 interceptions. Both teams combined 14 penalties, 109 yards, 2 for 7 in the red zone. I mean, listen, it was and the Eagles won by 11. It was a nice win for the Eagles, and defensively they did a nice job. I thought they were helped a little bit by the sloppiness of the Vikings. But their offense, the Eagles' offense in the first half, last 3 games, have only scored 13 points. I mean, they've done basically nothing since the first 3 games of the season, when they looked, you know, phenomenal and smooth, and Wentz looked like, you know, Joe Montana in his 9th year. It was one of those games. I just thought the reason I picked the Birds, one, I thought the line was a little too low. I thought the line stunk. It looked too easy to take Minnesota. I thought it was going to be one of those games. I thought the Eagles played so poorly in the Washington game that Jim Schwartz was going to devise. First of all, they got their butts kicked this week because of it, and I thought Jim Schwartz, who I do like as a defensive coordinator, I don't think he's long for a head coach in this league, but I agree with you. He's a good defensive coordinator, despite what you think about him personally, and I thought he did a nice job in terms of applying pressure to San Sam Bradford, because you know he's not going to get outside the pocket. You know he's not going to run. So if you collapse the pocket, you know, they were swiping and knocking the ball out of his hands and hands in his face, and they did a lot to make him very uncomfortable, and, you know, his numbers reflected that. He 224 yards, which to me, I don't even know where those numbers came from, but one TD, one interception, but they fumbled all over the place. They gave up a 98-yard kick return. Their special team, I mean, that doesn't happen in pro football these days because of where the ball is kicked. And they had an opportunity early in that game to put the Eagles away three times inside the red zone, and they could not hold on to the ball. And having said that, again, I don't think the Eagles are a team that's, you know, has done much for me that week to say, oh, well, they're going to be in the power rankings top 10. No. They still have a lot of issues, especially offensively. They don't have a wide receiver to speak of necessarily. And Wentz looks, you know, he's looks like a rookie. I mean, that one throw he had in the first half into triple coverage, I don't know what he was thinking or what he didn't see. You could see three purple shirts back there converging. He just kind of, you know, unleashed it. And, you know, he was running out of time. I did not like the way he played necessarily, but you're right. Doug Peterson pulled back the reins, made him a game manager in the second half, and, you know, thank God that Minnesota did not show up, because that could have gone a different way. I don't know any team that turns the ball over four times. Football gods are not very forgiving when you turn the ball over four times, and they turned the ball over four times and won by 11. It's the NFL. It's a week-to-week league. You know, go figure, Steve. I can never figure the NFL out. To me, though, I thought it was one of those games where I didn't think Minnesota would implode like that. I just had a hunch that the Eagles at home and with Sam Bradford and whatnot, and their familiarity with Sam Bradford, you know, kind of leaned in the favor of the Birds.
And you were right.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah, once in a while, not too often, but once in a while. All right, let's stay with the NFC East. The Giants go to London, and they go without their normal kicker, Josh Brown. We'll get to that in a sec. Eli Manning, no touchdown passes. They relied on four picks. Case Keenum, sometimes not in sync with his receivers. Did the Giants game winning out there do anything for you to bolster your thoughts on the G-Man?
Yeah, I have to say, and I'm a Giants fan, as you know, but not really. I mean, to get up early to watch the Giants and the Rams and then in New York to watch the Jet game, which eventually we'll get to, were just two incredibly ugly games by four bad teams, in my opinion. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see the Giants, again, getting to the playoffs or challenging. You know, the NFC East is better than I thought it was, but it's not great. And that was an ugly game. Case Keenum, you know, two of those were deflections. Did he throw it too hard? Were they catchable? You can debate that. But I will say Landon Collins had one of the great interception returns for a touchdown that I've ever seen, you know,
tremendous.
Catching the ricochet at the 45-yard line. And he must have broke eight tackles, no exaggeration. You can watch the tape, to get into the end zone, especially the last 10 yards when he was gang-tackled and still managed to get in. But, no, I thought the Giants' offense would be much more dominant, and I've been wrong. I don't think, you know, after they won those two close games, everyone forgets they beat Dallas week one, and look at Dallas now. But I just think they're kind of a mediocre team. And, again, I hope I'm wrong. As for the Rams, you know, I don't even know how Jeff Fisher gets contract extensions. I heard someone I think it might have been Ryan Clark on ESPN. I heard Ryan Clark say, yeah, Jeff Fisher's been in the league a long time, but he's been mediocre for an awful long time. And that's true. You know, there's the Jared Goff questions again. When is he going to come in? But if he's not ready to go now in the league where how many starting quarterbacks are rookies? Four, five, six now. It's unbelievable. And a few are playing well, not great. You know, the only one standing now to me is Dak Prescott. Wentz is fine, but he's not what he seemed to be the first few games. And you have other guys who are playing, but I just don't think – I think it's still true. The notion that you're going to have five rookie quarterbacks come into the NFL and play like gangbusters just isn't true. And don't forget Dak Prescott, as well as he's played – has the best offensive line in football in front of him, both from a running perspective to set up his play-action passes and from a protection perspective. So No, I really wasn't enthused, except that they won. And as you know, at the end of the day, it's did you win no matter how you got there, and they won.
No, totally agree with that. They came under a lot of scrutiny this week, Steve, with the Josh Brown situation. Your thoughts on that, because the Giants have been heavily criticized because now things are coming out, and even the owner went on the air and said, yeah, we knew that he had abused his wife and whatnot, and he obviously did not make the flight. He may never kick again in the National Football League. Your thoughts on how the Giants handled it or the way they went about things, and I guess your thoughts on how the NFL has handled it despite their stance and their program and all of what they say about how they want to be the leaders and the forerunners in the fight against domestic violence.
Yeah, just a disgrace. I mean, a national disgrace, not just a New York disgrace. And I'll say this, I know John Mara fairly well. I've known him over the years. And it's just shocking that he took the initial position for which he was criticized back in training camp. You know, they signed him to a two-year, $4 million deal with knowledge.
Right.
The only thing I can come up with, and look, Wellington Mara was a class act. John Mara is a class act. They've kind of been one of the franchises you look up to, for lack of a better word, one of the classy franchises, take care of their players. But this is an unmitigated disaster. He should, he should be cut. He should certainly never play for the Giants. I don't know if he should, I won't say he should never kick in the NFL again, but, I thought the Giants dropped the ball. To say we kind of knew that this happened but didn't know the extent of it. Once you know it happened once, you might recall Josh Brown said, oh, it was just a moment. But the problem is it's kind of like you're a robber and you get caught. It's probably not the first time you ever rob someone. If you see someone jump over a subway turnstile in New York and he gets caught, you can be sure he's probably done it, multiple times before. So that should be in today's world where we're more in tune to this, all the problems on college campuses and in the military and in general, especially post Ray Rice. I'll get into Goodell in a second. But I was very disappointed and very surprised. And he kind of dug himself a hole, John Mara. And now I'd be shocked if he ever kicks for the Giants again. He's on that magical exempt list that they almost seemed to invent last year, right? All the bad guys will put them on the exempt list until we figure out what the hell to do, which brings me to the NFL. I mean, the Ray Rice case was a disgrace. Roger Goodell had to see a video. I mean, everybody knew what happened. There were police reports. There was testimony. And to give him two games, because that's kind of how it was, one or two games, you smack your wife around and all the other things he did, that was preposterous. But with all those mistakes and all that reaction and all the women prosecutors that they hired to put in a policy, then to have the six-game policy, and then to have this guy – there was at least one episode of abuse. We now know there were plenty more. So once there's one, that's six games. So I still don't understand what happened. Yeah, I'm ashamed to say, frankly, because I never thought this would be something that John Mara and the Giants, and I'm still hearing the coach going, we're not going to desert him. He's a teammate. But I think if you have a brain, and some of these guys don't have a brain outside of football, I think you have to have an understanding of the bigger picture in America, in the country, on college campuses, in the military. This is an epidemic in America, and I think it would have been very easy. Look, you could say, we support him as a teammate, but what he did was despicable. I don't know if he'll be back. And then they should just cut him, and I assume they're going to cut him. But the only thing I can say, and I don't know how much this plays in the mind of John Mara, but, Josh Brown is an excellent kicker. And is it about winning and losing? You always have that, Hardy got another chance until he didn't get another chance anymore. So you have these guys, Ray Rice never got another chance, but it wasn't because I don't believe of the video. I think it was Ray Rice's last year with the Ravens averaged 3 yards a carry and wasn't good. So I think, unfortunately, still there's that little bit, this guy can help me win, I got to find a way to keep him in. But, a New York disgrace and a national disgrace and another Roger Goodell disgrace on top of, Goodell keeps his job because he makes these guys billions of dollars. There's no other reason why he can. In the Ray Rice scenario, if you did in your job or I did in my job what he did in his job, we'd be fired. But he's making
right.
a ton of money for these guys. And what, they cut his salary from $44 million to $35 million? Oh, what a punishment. So, yeah, I think the NFL looks terrible. The Giants do not look good. And as much as I like and respect John Mara, he doesn't come out of this one looking good either.
No, I totally agree. And you said it. You know, it's all about the money. Follow the money. I mean, there's different rules for different guys, and if you can help your team win. You know, it was the old Jimmy Johnson, you know, the third string running back falls asleep in a meeting, he gets cut. If Emmitt Smith falls asleep in a meeting, you get him a pillow. There's different rules for different guys, and if you have value, you know, you're going to get away with some things. But, you know, I agree. I think the NFL, just another black eye for the NFL, no pun intended, but we'll see how that situation unfolds. You know, the power rankings came out, at least the ESPN power rankings, Stevie. They had New England 1, obviously 6-1, no argument there. Seattle, despite a 6-6 tie, moves up to number 2. I'm sure you watched the game Sunday night, Arizona and Seattle. Two good defenses, but what a debacle at the end. I mean, your thoughts on just how that mess unfolded in overtime. And is Seattle, you know, in your opinion, worthy of a number 2 ranking in the power rankings in the National Football League?
Well, as you know, I picked the Patriots to beat Seattle in the Super Bowl before the season started. And I'll just say a couple of things. The Seahawks are number 2 by default. And the Patriots, who I thought, just to touch on the Patriots, I thought they played poorly the other day, and they still won by 11. But, you know, no Big Ben. So I think the Patriots came back to the pack a little bit the other day, but still head and shoulders over everybody. We'll talk about them in Buffalo in a minute. That's a fascinating game to me. But the Seahawks, from what I can hear now and what I read and what I see, the key to Seattle's offense, of course, is Russell Wilson. Their defense is excellent. But he had a big knee brace on the other day. He wasn't as mobile. Seattle's, you know, I picked them to make the Super Bowl despite knowing they had a terrible offensive line, and that's certainly something you would run away from. But Russell Wilson is one of the smartest guys, if not the smartest guy in the league in terms of running and sliding.
Yep.
I've said 100 times all these quarterbacks, including Cam Newton, including Ryan Fitzpatrick, should get Russell Wilson tapes and learn how to slide. They should literally take sliding lessons. You know, RG3. Another guy.
Yeah,
so,
right.
But I think Russell Wilson is hurt. They did say he's wearing a big knee brace. Certainly his mobility has been compromised. And if he can't do that with a bad offensive line, he's almost a stand-in-the-pocket guy. And if he's a stand-in-the-pocket guy, if Seattle had a stand-in-the-pocket quarterback, they would not be winning games. Now, that was the ugliest game. Great defense, but an ugly game. And I'll just say this about the kickers. If you had to look at sports in the last 40 or 50 years, when, you know, guys were kicking straight ahead 50 years ago, I don't think anything's been improved more in any sport than field goal kicking. To see these two guys miss these two kicks is just kind of hard to believe. Arian said it best. This isn't high school. You get paid to make these kicks. But I will say this about Seattle kicking. You know, Pete Carroll, who made the worst decision maybe in the history of pro football, make the right decision, you probably win the Super Bowl. Make the wrong decision,
yep,
you can lose the Super Bowl. Although I did try and help him when I said, had you faked to Marshawn Lynch on that play, if you were going to be dumb enough to throw it, had you faked to Marshawn Lynch in that play, you would have had two guys waving in the end zone by themselves. You know, the tight end and the lineman who reports as a receiver. They would have been waving it.
Yep.
So he made a doubly stupid mistake. After this game, and I don't know if you watched the clock at the end, but the play clock was at like 2 seconds when they snapped the ball for Hauschka to miss his. Can't miss it by much more than he missed it. But Hauschka's a good field goal kicker. Seattle had a timeout left. Carroll was questioned after the game about that, and he goes, well, I saw that we were in our rhythm, and if we weren't in our rhythm, I was going to call time. But he outthinks himself, as he did in the Super Bowl. If you're getting down to 5-4, 3-2, even if you're in the rhythm, that's so close that either you should at that point either take a 5-yard penalty or call timeout. So I was shocked that he did not call timeout. They did get the kickoff. Of course, he missed it. But it's almost like poetic justice, that particular game. But I think Seattle is second by default because the Vikings went backwards. The Patriots should still be first. The Broncos played great, you know, last night, but they've fallen backwards the last few weeks. I don't know who the other contenders are. Who are you going to put, I guess, would be the question, over the Seahawks? I really think it's a default situation.
That's an excellent point. We'll touch on the Patriots now, 6-1. Their only loss, the last game of Tom Brady's suspension to the Buffalo Bills, 16-0 in Foxborough this week. They're coming off a win over the Steelers. Like you mentioned, they didn't play great, but they did win, and they covered. And in Buffalo this week, 6.5-point favorite. Your thoughts heading into Buffalo, who's also been playing very good football this matchup this Sunday?
Yeah, I'm going to take the Joe Stasak approach when I pick the Patriots today, because that line looks way too high. I mean, the Bills beat them 16-0, yes, without Tom Brady, but they beat them in Foxborough. The Bills have played very well until their collapse, and maybe this is one of the reasons why it is 6.5, until their collapse against the Miami Dolphins in Miami. Whatever you think of Miami, and I don't think much of them, they always give certainly the Patriots and others trouble in Miami. Tannehill, for all the money they've given him, he's kind of a game manager now. You know, Ajayi now looks like a legit running back. Only four guys in the history of the league have got 200 yards rushing back-to-back games, and it's Earl Campbell, and O.J. did it twice, and Ricky Williams.
Yep.
So you're talking big, strong, powerful backs, and this guy's a very powerful guy with some speed, of course, which is the combination you need. So I like the Patriots. Obviously, I still think this is the Tom Brady post-Deflategate, like it was the New England Patriots post-Spygate March. I don't think they played well. It looked to me like if the Steelers had Big Ben, it would have been a game. But again, you say, oh, the Patriots didn't play well, and they scored four touchdowns, like one in every quarter. And the Steelers have a very good defense that had nothing to do without Big Ben. The other thing just quickly that popped into my head going back to the Seahawks, my recollection now that I'm thinking about it is that the Seahawks defense was on the field for 45 minutes. So that's an astounding defensive performance against Carson Palmer. So I just wanted to throw that back out, because I do think the Seahawks should be ranked number two, although I still think it's by default. But getting back to the Patriots and the Bills, to me this line is too high, but I'm going to pick the Patriots anyway, because if anyone is going to be out for revenge, it's going to be Belichick against Rex Ryan, who, whatever you think of Rex Ryan, has been able to at least play and beat the Patriots on occasion, you know, including a playoff game in Foxborough with Mark Sanchez, which now in retrospect looks like a miracle. So I think they're going to go all out to embarrass the Bills if they can. I don't know if they can. The Bills are a very good team. Prior to this game, I thought they might be the second-best team, certainly in the AFC, prior to losing to Miami. And as I said, all these teams at the top kind of backed off a little bit in the last week. So I think, again, that's why the Seahawks are number two.
All right, we're running out of time. Before we get to our picks and how we did last week and this week, real quickly, the Jets, they're you know, the big win, if you will, over the Ravens. The Geno Smith out for the year, unfortunately, with the torn ACL, Ryan Fitzpatrick, that whole mess. And they have the worst, toughest schedule in the league. Your thoughts on that game, and did it mean anything, and did you have any problem or issues with what Ryan Fitzpatrick said after the game in terms of believing in himself, no one else does? Your thoughts?
I don't have problems, because Ryan Fitzpatrick is already playing for his next job. It's not going to be with the Jets. You know, some people think they didn't give him a long-term contract and that hurt his performance. I don't know that it did or didn't. You're a professional. You're getting $12 million, you know. But I kind of agree with what Ryan Fitzpatrick says. But, look, there's a reason. I like him. He played great last year, again, as we talked about early on, against a weak schedule. And now he didn't play so well against an incredibly tough schedule. I like the Ravens in this game because I didn't think Geno could do well. He did hit Anua for that 68-yard touchdown, but that was like a 10-yard crossing route, and he ran 58 yards, so I wasn't going to be too excited about Geno. But once Fitzpatrick comes in, it does seem he plays better when he's really upset, and he did, you know, 9 for 14. He led him down the field for a big touchdown, so I don't have a problem with what he said. The Jets are still in disarray, so they're 2-5 now, and yeah, they have some easy games coming up, but they haven't played the Patriots yet, so it's going to be, as we've talked about, it's going to be hard for them to, in my opinion, to be, you know, 8-8. And he might run off 3 or 4 in a row because they have an easy schedule now. But Fitzpatrick is playing for next year, a different contract. Geno, I think, is gone. You know, his contract is up this year. I don't know about the guys on the bench because they haven't played. You know, you have to make Bryce Petty, I guess, your backup now. But as we said, as we talked before, they have four quarterbacks, but I don't think they have any quarterback for next year.
Totally agree. I have a little less than 2 minutes left, Steve. Your picks last week, how'd you do, and who do you like this week?
Yeah, I didn't do well. I like Minnesota. I should have listened to you. I like the Ravens. I went 1-3 with a push. But I'm going to come back this week, again, going against what I think. But I like road favorites, which I know is not a good thing to like. But the Patriots, 6.5, to me, if you're a gambler, you're going to pick the Bills. But I think there's a – again, post-Deflategate, we're going to roll over the league. And as I said, they played poorly and beat the Steelers in Pittsburgh by 11, admittedly with Landry Jones, who played okay. But I like the Patriots minus 6.5 over the Bills. I like the Chiefs to bounce back minus, even though they won, I thought they would be even better than that. Chiefs minus 2.5 over the Colts, who, you know, can barely keep Andrew Luck standing up, although they had a good win. And I like the Vikings Monday night, I believe, in the Zimmer, Parcells, we're going to turn this around quickly. Vikings, 4.5, Monday night, on the road against the Bears, who, even though they might get Jay Cutler back, I think it's already kind of a lost season for the Chicago Bears. How about you?
Totally agree. Real quickly, believe it or not, I went 3-0. I had New England
yes.
over Pittsburgh, minus 7.5. I had the Birds, as we mentioned, plus the 2.5, and I had Detroit. I can't even remember if they were plus 1.5 or minus, but a late touchdown. Matthew Stafford takes them back. They get it done. Here's what I like this week. I like New England. I'm along with you, minus 6.5. I like Carolina at home, minus 2.5 over Arizona. I think that line's a little screwy for a 1-5 football team. And I like the Packers, plus 3 in Atlanta, looking to get things right. Atlanta, to me, is an up-and-down team. We shall see. Aaron Rodgers had a big week last week, and we'll see if that continues. Steven, appreciate it. Always a pleasure, my friend. We'll talk to you next week on Callous Remarks with Steve Callous and Joe Stazek. Thanks, pal. Enjoy the World Series tonight, my friend.
Can't wait. See you next.
The Coventry University Group is on the move and growing fast with the brand new CU London campus opening September next year, offering full-time and part-time foundation and degree courses from a top 15 UK university in engineering, science, health, policing, law, management and much more, all with flexible entry dates and no end-of-year exams. Find out more today at coventry.ac.uk/CUL. CU London, your destination, your future.